Some people consider that. The interesting thing is that was the lowest point of the euro's valuation. It was 82 cents to the dollar. So when he made this announcement, people scratched their head and said, well, he's going to lose $400 million over the next year because the euro is not worth as much as the dollar. But what happened is after he made the switch, the euro began to appreciate, and the UN Oil for Food Program had $10 billion in it when he made the switch. By the time the war started, in February of 2003, it was actually reported in the UK Guardian, the Oil for Food Program had gone from $10 billion to 26 billion euros. It almost tripled the profits of his country by switching to the currency. Now, when the Bush administration overthrew Saddam, the very first thing they did in May of 2003 was reconvert Iraq's oil transactions from the euro back to the dollar, even though economically the euro is worth 17% more than the dollar.
So at that point, the decision by the Bush administration to go back to the dollar cost the Iraqi government.
The Iraqi people, yes.
The Iraqi people, a whole lot of money.
Billions.
This all got very little coverage in the mainstream media at the time.
No coverage. Almost no coverage.
You giggle like a girl at that prospect, William. Why do you think that's funny that it got no coverage?
Well, you're in New Zealand. I'm in the United States. When I wrote my essay, I had my first call was from Brisbane, Australia, before the war. I had Australia call me. I had Johannesburg, South Africa do an interview with me on the radio. I had Brazil. So I had these people from around the world calling me, and yet in the United States, hardly anyone would talk about this. I mean, I had a few small independent media outlets who did talk to me about it, but it seems like the rest of the world knows about this, but it's sort of a secret here in the United States, and even Canada. I had Canadian people interview me. It's interesting, this whole issue. It's like, the media in the United States, there's only five corporations that control 90% of what we see, read, and hear in the United States. And this is all in my book, and I talk about this. But it's a very taboo subject.
Do you think that Saddam Hussein's determination to trade oil in euros rather than US dollars was a factor in the Bush administration's determination to have regime change in Iraq?
Yes. I think the neoconservatives are being driven by two issues. Number one, they've had their sights on Iraq for a long time. It has to do with a phenomenon called global peak oil, which is a whole other subject, very controversial, which I've been studying very intently. So I think Dick Cheney knows very much that the world global oil production will be reaching a peak in the near term, and Saddam or Iraq had the last cheap reserves, and Saddam, during the late 1990s, from 97 to 1999, had signed all these contracts with the Chinese, with the French, and with the Russians, and 27 other countries to develop the oil. But the United States was locked out, and so was British Petroleum. So if Iraq is sitting on supposedly the second largest world reserves, but you know United States companies can go in there, yet the Chinese and the French and the Russians are lined up, as soon as the sanctions were dropped, which they should have been, because everyone knew it was disarmed, then all the Iraqi oil infrastructure could be reinvigorated by foreign oil companies, but not the United States. So it had to be regime change to, you know, get the United States in there to get some of that oil. But also, I think the final thing, when Saddam went to the euro, that was it. It was like they already had their eye on Iraq. They had it on in the late 90s when he signed all the two-thirds of Iraq's oil over to the French and the Russians and Chinese. But when he made the switch to the euro, he was threatening the dollar as the world's reserve currency. Even though it really depends on the other OPEC members, but it was a challenge to the dollar as the world's reserve currency, and no other OPEC members dared do that, even though they talked about it in the 1970s. It wasn't until September of 2000 Saddam said he was going to do this, and then it happened in November. So that was a challenge to the dollar. This is what the Europeans were like, well, good, our currency should be able to buy oil, but the Bush administration said, no, this is not going to happen. We have to get rid of Saddam, and that's why, you know, the former Treasury Secretary John O'Neill, in his very first meeting in January of 2001, Bush had just been in office 10 days, and the number one item on the national security meeting was getting rid of Saddam. This was 8 months before September 11th. So they came into the office wanting to get rid of Saddam because Saddam actually made a switch to the euro the day before the United States election. Our elections were on November the 7th of 2000. The switch took place, I believe, on November 6, 2000. So this whole period, even before they came into power, they knew that this was taking place.
Well, Len, what about Iran? Because it intends to do this too on what, March 20, something like that?
Right, March 21st. Yes, Iran actually made the switch to euros for oil payments in the middle of 2003, in the middle of the war. They import a lot of oil to Italy and whatnot, and Italy and these countries pay Iran in euros. However, and also the Asian countries are paying Iran in euros, but the oil transactions are still priced in the dollar, because right now most of the oil that's traded in the world is traded through the New York Mercantile Exchange or the London IPE, which stands for the International Petroleum Exchange. And those are both dollar-denominated. You've got the Brent crude, which is a dollar-denominated, you know, for London, and you've got the WTI, West Texas Intermediate crude, which is down in within New York Mercantile Exchange sales. And there's also a Dubai oil exchange. But what the Iranians are planning on doing is not only having oil payments in the euros, they're going to do oil pricing. And that is that's sort of a complicated macroeconomic issue. But basically what that means is, if this thing is somewhat successful, central banks, you know, in a few months are going to have to make a decision whether they want to hold, let's say I need to buy 1 million barrels of oil next month. Do I want, and let's say the price of oil is $70. Do I want to hold $70 million, or do I want to hold 55 million euros, because the euro is worth about 20% more than the dollar? So there's going to be what they call currency hedging, and the euro will become a de facto world reserve currency if it is the pricing or the unit of account for oil. And that's what Tehran is trying to do.
So is that more of a threat potentially to the United States than Iran's nuclear ambitions?
I think so. The Soviet Union, or the former Soviet Union, had 7,000 nuclear weapons. There's a concept that we used to talk about. It was called MAD. It was called Mutually Assured Destruction. So Iran doesn't want to commit national suicide. They're not going to launch a nuclear attack against Israel, because Israel has a couple hundred nuclear weapons, and they're not going to attack us, because it would be suicide for them. You know, it's I still believe that, you know, that the concept of MAD exists. And so it's really because the United States is so in debt. Iran they're not threatening us. You know, they're just trying to get out from under the dollar. And there's been sanctions against Iran ever since 1979 with the Iranian Revolution. So they can't even use dollars in their country. It's not even legal. U.S. companies cannot do business in Iran. So for them to go to the euro, from a purely economic perspective, it just makes sense economically and monetarily. It doesn't make sense for them to do this in the dollar, because you can't use dollars in Iran, and there's these sanctions against Iran from the United States. So what they're doing from an objective perspective makes sense, but what it's doing is it is challenging the U.S. dollar as the petrodollar with a petro-euro.
If you're talking about cents, it also makes sense, doesn't it, for some other countries, and I'm thinking of Russia here, which is the second biggest exporter of oil.
Right.
It makes sense for Russia to trade in the euro, because it's part of Europe, and most of its trade is in Europe. Is it also talking about changing?
That is the big question. Vladimir Putin, the president of Russia, made a few statements in October of 2003. Someone asked him, you know, are you going to switch to the euro for your oil trades? And he said, we don't rule that out. That would be interesting for our European partners. You're right. 80% of Russia's oil is sold to the European Union. The European Union wants to have that oil priced in the euro, because it eliminates their currency risk, and they don't have to hold as many depreciating dollars in their banks. So people say to me, well, Iran is only, you know, exporting 2.5 million barrels a day. It's not that much oil. But what they don't understand is that Iran is opening up this exchange, saying anybody, you know, whether you be Kuwait or Saudi Arabia or Russia or whoever you are, if you're selling and buying oil, you're welcome to use our oil exchange. So to me, the big thing to watch in 2006 is, what does Russia do? Do they make a switch to the petro-euro? And, you know, there's been statements, and the Russians have said, you know, well, if we do that, there's going to be great opposition from the United States. In my book, I say that is a colossal understatement, because Russia is 9.5 million barrels of oil, second behind Saudi Arabia in oil production. But from a purely, again, from a purely economic perspective, if 80% of their oil gets sold to the European Union, then selling it and pricing it in the euro and using the Iranian oil bourse or oil stock exchange market makes perfect sense. But because the United States is so in debt and we use the dollar flows of the petrodollar flows to finance our trade and budget deficits, it's going to cause a macroeconomic problem for our country because we can't continue supporting the twin deficits.
So in the medium term, short to medium term, President Putin may decide to stick with the US dollar because he doesn't want to provoke George Bush. But I guess, I mean, Putin has taken quite an independent foreign policy line. We've seen that in recent days with his attitude to Hamas and their election in the Palestinian authorities. But equally, in the war with Iraq, Russia was never in favour of that. Now, if the Americans do strike Iran, and that's hypothetical at this stage, but if they did, it's possible then, isn't it, that Russia could respond by switching to the euro at that point, and then cite they'd been provoked in a way.
Yes, I'm, that is what I call in my book the rogue nation hypothesis. There is a real danger here regarding Iran. If the United States strikes unilaterally, militarily against Iran, then because China, I think Iran is the second largest oil importer into China. They're getting 14% of their oil there. And so you've got Russia and China interested in Iran's oil, and they have these contracts. So if we do something stupid, then you're right. Russia could say, well, I guess we'll go ahead and switch over to the petro-euro, and that will cause some problems here. So what everyone wants to do is to do things very gradually. I mean, it needs to be, if they move to the petro-euro, that's fine, but it needs to be done incrementally over several years. But there's a real risk if Putin gets upset, if the Chinese get upset with the United States' actions in the Persian Gulf, that they have the ability to strike back economically.
You say the best plan is that if everyone moves slowly, but there is a pressure against moving slowly, and you mentioned that a little earlier in this conversation, and that is global peak oil. If the Americans really have bought this idea that in the short term we're going to reach this peak oil moment, for a country so addicted to oil, as the President said in the State of the Union address, they don't have a lot of time left, do they?
Well, this is a complicated question. Yes, the whole world is addicted to oil, but we, of course, as Americans, are probably the most addicted. We use most of it, or more than anyone else. But the problem with warfare is it's very unpredictable. I mean, Iraq, for example, last month, January, the oil exports were, I think, 1.1 million barrels. I mean, it hasn't been that low since, I don't know when, since 1990. And military activity in the Persian Gulf and in Iran in particular has the potential to shut off 25% of the world's oil supply, because 25% of the oil gets shipped through the Strait of Hormuz, which is near, which borders Iran. So if peak oil is imminent, which I think it is, what we need to have is a multilateral United States government and a multilateral world body sitting around saying, okay, we've got a real crisis here. We need to work together. We need to use Apollo-type energy programs as fast as possible. We need to work on this currency issue. So in my book, in the last two chapters, I go all these different policy suggestions.
Yeah, but I mean, the current American administration doesn't like multilateral moves.
I know. That's why I wrote the book. I warned the American people that we face a currency crisis and an energy crisis, and we have to work with the international community together to get through this transition, because if we don't, it's going to be a lot of hardship and a very hard time.
Do you think the Bush administration will strike Iran?
I hope not. I just don't know. There are a lot of leaks from people in the Air Force and from the CIA who are very worried, because they've been asked to do the war game of an aerial attack on Iran against suspected nuclear facilities. And these people in the United States military and in the CIA are very nervous, because they they're saying this is going to be awful if we're ordered to do this. We don't want to do this. So they're leaking these things to the media. So I hope that the Bush administration understands that the tactical risk, the strategic risk, the economic risk, the political risk is so great that they will not do this. But I go back and forth. Sometimes I think, okay, they're not going to do it, but then I read, you know, another leak from someone in the Air Force saying, you know, we're looking at tactical nuclear weapons deployment against Iran potentially, and it scares me, and it scares these people who are making the leak. So I really don't know the answer. I hope that we don't, because if they do attack Iran, that to me will usher in a period of just unprecedented global turmoil. We have not seen that kind of stuff since 1940. That's what we'd be looking at, in my opinion.
Well, you've given us plenty of things to chew over. You know, worried us silly for the morning. It's been very nice having you on the program, though. William Clark, I've been talking to William Clark. He's an award-winning writer and security analyst in the United States. His book is called Petrodollar Warfare, Oil, Iraq, and the Future of the Dollar.
William Clark, author of Petrodollar Warfare, speaking with Radio New Zealand's Linda Clark. Microeconomics, macroeconomics, Keynesianism, what do these economic theories mean, and do they appropriately reflect reality? And if so, whose? Does Karl Marx's economic theory better describe how market capitalism actually works? Our last speaker, economist Mel Lyman, says yes. He's a professor emeritus of economics from SUNY Binghamton and is author of the classic textbook, The Political Economy of Racism. Last year, he gave a public lecture series titled Teaching Radical Alternatives in Bainbridge Island, Washington. Our next talk is from that series. Here's Professor Mel Lyman.
I was thinking on the way over here why some theories become part of the mainstream and other theories are on the minor stream. Why, for example, is Marxism off the mainstream, not in a dominant position? I know it's got its adherents, like me and others, but in no sense would anybody say, especially now in a world dominated by America and the capitalist system, that it's the mainstream. So what is the mainstream? The mainstream is clearly microeconomics, which is advocated by the neoliberals, and some variation of macroeconomics, which is dominated by a man named Keynes, and suitably modified, in some cases partially replaced. And so I started to ask myself, why are those theories dominant in the two variations? And Marxism, which, as I will show you, deals more effectively with certain problems. And by the way, I am not going to present the idea that everything that Marx said was revealed wisdom. I concluded that there's a certain body of ideas that give an intellectual justification to the system in power, and that it's reasonable to understand why those ideas would be considered the mainstream. In the market, we have no control over the prices. In other words, we adjust to the prices that exist, and within the constraints of limited income, we try to maximize what economists call utility or well-being. How does that fit in with the needs of capitalism? Well, I think it does, in this sense. It abstracts from the labor-capital relationship. In other words, each of us and Gates go into the market. He obviously with more money, but he maximizes his income and the well-being from that income, and we do the same. So there is no labor-capital relation there. You see, because we're all acting as isolated individuals, as pleasure-maximizing individuals or pain-minimizing individuals. And that's the way the theory developed. So it's abstracting from what in reality is the fundamental relationship in society, namely that we live in a private property society. There's a class of people that have accumulated more private property than others, and they hire the labor services, right? How does that get into orthodox theory? Well, it comes in at the second level. First is maximization of satisfaction by consumers. This gives a signal to capitalists, if they want to maximize profits, to produce what people want. In other words, the first level is the consumer, the second level is the producer. Right? Then the capitalist tries to minimize the costs of producing what people want, because in minimizing their costs, and they're very effective at it, you know, if they can get more by shipping production to Bangladesh out of Bainbridge Island, you can believe that they will do it, you know, with a minimum of moral restrictions in their head. Then the third step is that in the process of production, labor gets a wage, the capitalist gets profit, the money capitalist gets interest income, and the owner of land gets rent. What you then have is the idea that everybody, these four groups, the worker, the two capitalists, and the landowner, they're called factors of production, get a return that reflects their productivity at the margin. In other words, the more productive you are, the more you get. Now, notice that that too, even though there are classes in there, there's no class conflict. Everybody gets roughly what they deserve in market terms. So that is the way orthodox theory at a micro level deals with very vital economic ideas: production, distribution, operations of consumers, and the various factors of production. You will see in a little while that this is in fundamental conflict with what I regard as a much more real theory, and that is a Marxist theory that first looks at this as a process, a historical process, raises the question, where do these capitalists come from? See, there's the implicit idea that long, long ago, there was a group of people that tightened their belts, didn't consume all their income, put it aside, invested it, got a return, invested more, and the other people lived from hand to mouth, saved nothing. They were just looking at making do. And so out of those two different types of people, you eventually had classes. Well, that's malarkey. What really happened is that the beginnings of capitalism was a very bloody mess. You had various European powers, in particular Spain and England, going all over the world, ripping off natives, bringing home gold, also bringing home slaves, very profitable thing, that eventually helped to trigger off the Industrial Revolution. As Marx put it rather strongly, capitalism came into the world dripping with gore. Capitalism didn't start as we know it here today with a very clearly defined capitalist class, landowning class, lending class. For a considerable period of time, you had a very primitive kind of capitalism. In fact, it's almost what you might call a petty mode of production. That is, where each of us produce a product, and we bring it to a market, and we sell it. With that, over time, some capitalists became greater. And in particular, what was done in England, which was the center of the capitalist world, is that an independent peasantry was forced off the land. In fact, millions of them came to America out of great poverty. Because what they did, they were commons land that was used for grazing and cutting wood to survive cold winters. That was enclosed. Obviously, only a small number of people got that land. The people that were a small peasantry became part of the new working class. The wool industry was the first industry. because there were so many sheep. And in fact, it is said that in Scotland, that sheep replaced people. And that's and it's true. In fact, to this day, if you go to Scotland, into the Highlands, you'll see miles and miles of sheep and Scotch producers. Very few people. That's the end product. So what Marxism adds is a historical dimension. They're saying, how did capitalism grow out of feudalism? How did the class structure evolve? How did it change over time? How did monopoly capital develop out of competitive capital? And the last wrinkle in our recent lifetime, how did globalization develop, which is like an advanced step of monopoly capital? And so what we see with Marx is, first, that it's superior in terms of how the economy evolved, how technology changed over time, how the structure of society changed, how class relations evolved. And the whole key to the system with Marx that is absent from this neoliberal vision is, how did the capitalists acquire surplus value? Marx develops the idea that the worker, under average conditions, over the long run, produces more value than they receive. And you might say, observing the system, so what's new? Because that's exactly what exists today. Marx called this relationship between profits and wages, he uses a technical term, surplus value and variable capital. But think in terms that you know, and that is profits and wages, where profits come out of the fact that the worker produces more value than they receive. Right? The symbols that Marx uses, which I contend will change the way you look at capitalism, is S over V, or profits divided by wages. Once you have that in mind, the notion of neutrality in the system, for example, a dominant idea in Orthodox theory, is that the state is neutral, just as they say the justice system is neutral. You will see via this S over V that exploitation of workers as a class by capitalists as a class is a normal, necessary feature. And Marx doesn't use it necessarily in a pejorative way. He's looking at it scientifically. That's what happens. A property-owning class hires workers. They're not slaves, workers, for a certain period of time. And he pays them a subsistence, a socially defined subsistence wage. But they produce more value than they receive, and that surplus value goes to the capitalist. Marx then, and here's another enormous leap forward, the only one of the period, he sees competitive capitalism leading to monopoly capitalism. Because there's out of the struggle for survival, there's a process of what he calls concentration of capital, in other words, producing in larger and larger units because you get economies of scale, and centralization of capital, which is the larger capitalists buying up the smaller capitalists. It is that process that reflects what he calls a class struggle. Now, you can read any orthodox economic text and you will never see the word class struggle, because the nature of this micro theory is that everybody is getting a return which reflects the value that they produce at the margin. No class struggle. Implicitly, there's the idea of fairness, and that, I think, has prevented orthodox thinkers from understanding the laws of motion of capitalist society, how it evolves, the role that technology plays. The orthodox thinkers, in the face of the Great Depression came up with a new level of analysis. Because you see, the first level of analysis, the micro level, assumed that there was full employment. In the Great Depression, that was pretty hard assumption to continue because you had 25% of the labor force unemployed, another percentage only partially employed. And if anything, these figures may be understatements because our statistics gathering at that point was not the best. In fact, it's not perfect now because we find that there's an understatement of the true rate of unemployment now because many people that have been unemployed for a significant period of time drop out of the labor force. They've given up. In terms of official statistics, they don't exist, just as people on the street don't exist, even though our visual sense tells us they not only exist, but their numbers are growing. So in the 1930s, you had the second part of orthodox theory, and that's called macroeconomics. It was developed first by a man by the name of Keynes. What Keynes said is microeconomics is correct as far as it goes, but we first have to determine the level of national income and national employment. Once we have done that, micro theory is correct. Then people do get paid according to the value of their contribution. And so he developed a very significant addition. It had one thing in common with a Marxist vision, and that is Keynes said the level of employment fluctuated, that full employment was a special case, that the norm of capitalism was to bump along at various levels of unemployment. And it was the first time orthodox economists used the term unemployment. Before that, it existed, but only in a few footnotes, because unemployment was seen as voluntary. In other words, if you were unemployed, it was because you had what they called a high leisure preference, as if you were making a choice. You know, do I work or do I not work? Unemployment as an involuntary act, as coming out of the system, was first developed among orthodox economists in the 1930s. Now, Marx had said that back in the 1860s, and a few other people had bits and pieces of that. But as I say, there's a difference between being the major stream and the minor stream. And so Keynes said that even though the norm of capitalism is to bump along at various levels of unemployment, the government, run by intelligent economists, can use monetary and fiscal policy in a way effective enough to produce full employment without inflation. Keynes was, without any shadow of a doubt, the major economist of the 20th century. And moreover, for a certain period from World War II until the middle 70s, capitalism, using Keynesian tools, operated relatively well. It's the golden age of capitalism, helped along, of course, by the fact that we were the only nation to have emerged from World War II stronger than when we got in. We, in effect, replaced Britain, who was the leading power before. So what Keynes was saying is that it was the level of what he called effective demand, that is, demand for goods by consumers and by capitalists in the form of investment, that determined the level of employment and income. If it was creating less than full employment, then what the government needed to do was to lower taxes. He didn't deal with the question of which class taxes should be lowered for. Increase government spending. Didn't deal with whether it would be houses for the poor or bombs for the army. And that was the on the fiscal side, where you look at spending and taxes. And on the monetary side, he wanted to encourage people to spend more because if you have unemployment, spending is the way to improve things for the economy. The methods for doing that would be to lower the interest rate. And you could do that, he felt, through increasing the money supply. Because if the interest rate is low, we will go in and borrow to buy a car, let's say, or a house, and the capitalists will go in to borrow for investing in their business. And the reverse would occur if we were in an inflationary picture. Then you want to contract the economy, right? So this was quite a brilliant addition. But notice, again, that it does not focus on the basic fact of life in capitalist society, namely that we are divided by classes. What he, in effect, was saying is that investment is the volatile element in our society. If the capitalist is temporarily not in the proper mental state for spending, then the government has to stand ready to do something. Now, there is no theory of business cycles here, but at least there is an admission that business cycles are a fact of life. Does Marxism have anything to contribute to this? Well, I think it does, because although Marx does not have one specific business cycle theory, he was a pioneer in pointing out that the exploitation of the working class left them with insufficient purchasing power to buy the goods that profit-motivated capitalists were flooding the market with. That was way before Keynes and much more incisive. Because, you see, Marx was trying to get to the laws of development and decline of the system, while Keynes was a pragmatist. He was saying, capitalism without the government operates ineffectively. We cannot accept the Great Depression. We have to do something. So his is a focus on what do you do in order to make the system function effectively. So he doesn't look at how cycles are connected with development and how in the process of development, capitalism is incapable of having a steady development. It is always interrupted. It's interrupted because the investment sector and the consuming sector get out of phase with one another. The only way you will not have cycles is if there is proportionate development of all sectors. And that's almost impossible. Almost impossible. First of all, in the process of a business cycle, the distribution of income changes. And when that changes, the different sectors get out of phase with one another. And that was a second part of business cycle theory that Marx developed. It's very complex. It's even mathematical. If he was had come to bourgeois conclusions, I'm sure every graduate student would read it. As it is, far less than 1% read it. I never had a lecture on Marx in all the time I was in graduate school. And I was in New York City, Columbia. I'm not presenting that as the greatest education in the world because the best part of it was small groups of us teaching ourselves. But in the process, we did have to master orthodox theory. But we were being taught it as revealed truth. And the price of doing that was a mythical picture of a society without struggle between classes, without having laws of motion which revealed that capitalism was only a stage in the development of society, that it grew out of feudalism, and that due to its laws of development, it was creating the conditions for its eventual displacement. For example, imagine that capitalists get larger and larger. What happens to the people that were capitalists? They become members of the working class. So the laws of development of capitalism lead to a continual enlargement of the working class and a smaller capitalist class. Some of the conclusions that Marx came to have not worked out. And one was that Marx believed that capitalism would break down in its most advanced centers. And his reasoning was something like this. Who makes a revolution? Answer, workers. Where are workers most powerful? In the most developed country. But history, in fact, reveals that capitalism broke down at what one Marxist called its weakest link rather than its strongest arena, and that was the Soviet Union. Because I'm sure that some of you have the idea that the Soviet Union is an example of Marxism on an applied level, I'm going to say a few words about it. This is obviously controversial because I'm sure that you have been inundated with Russia as the evil empire, and truth to tell, I detested the Soviet Union, but from a different angle of vision, and that is, it was under the stress of trying to continue an unpopular war that capitalism, with many feudal elements, by the way, in the Soviet Union, broke down, and Russia was ripped out of the world capitalist orbit. But they were in uncharted waters. Marx didn't tell them what to do, because Marx never dreamed that it would happen there. So what they did was to nationalize property. If you had stock in companies, they became just antiques. They changed private property into social ownership and private markets into a planned economy. And in point of fact, Russia experienced an extremely rapid growth rate, also experienced an industrial revolution, because at the time of World War I and the revolution, about 75% of the population were peasants, hardly conducive to the working class that is the maker of worker revolutions. But be that as it may, here you had a small group of people seizing control, ousting the other group, having a terrible civil war in which they barely survived, and they created an industrial revolution, educated a group of people with very low levels of education, created a culture, developed science. After all, you know, they did send people to space. You only do that if you have a well-developed society. All that's on the positive side. The negative side, and this eventually was its undoing, I believe, it created a totally authoritarian state. I think capitalism is far from a real democracy, but it was far more democratic than the Soviet Gulag system. There's no doubt about that. Everybody except true believers who are as irrational on that level as many people are who see capitalism as the only or highest form of democracy. That's a myth of a higher order and held by many, many more people. In fact, I wouldn't be surprised if a majority in America believed that. By the end of the 70s, the Russian system developed severe strains, and even with its planned economy, its rate of growth declined quite sharply, and the planning system developed all sorts of problems. And the question is, did American capital, world capitalism, win the struggle with Soviet so-called communism because it was inherently superior and that the Russian system was like an old dinosaur? Well, my impression is that capitalism is efficient. Capitalists run the system by allocating resources where it will get the greatest return. A planned economy can have one level of superiority, but only one. The level is that they avoid business cycles. Even if they have gulags, they avoid business cycles. And even the people in the gulags were mining gold under the worst conditions in the world. They weren't sitting in jail having a good time. Even if a planned economy, and this was true of the Soviet Union, is not allocating resources efficiently between this use and that use and that use, they used their resources to a higher degree than we did. That is, they used it to 100%. They did not have unemployment. We typically operate with idle workers, idle plants for part of the time. And so for a significant period of time, the Russians could overcome, I'll call it their micro-level efficiency, inefficiency, with a macro-level efficiency, that is, full employment, even though they misutilized their resources. But they could not make the conversion to a high-tech society, and that started to be their undoing. And the question is why? Why could they be efficient for a while, although at a truly incredibly high price in terms of liberty and also forced collectivization in which there were millions of people that died? Why could they not make that leap? Is it due to the – you got two choices. It's due to the nature of planning that it's simply inferior, or there's a political explanation. I take the second approach. I believe that the only way that a planned economy can compete effectively with a capitalist market economy is if it has a high level of workers' democracy. Why? Because without workers' democracy, the signals that go up from the plant to the managers and from the managers to the overall planners, they're simply not going to be true. Everyone's trying to protect themselves. And so the absolute fundamental prerequisite for the long-time effectiveness of a planned economy is workers' control. And what do I mean by workers' control? I mean that workers decide through a democratic process what to produce, how to produce it, how to share in the output. And that's exactly what you did not have in the Soviet Union. Now, you have infinitely greater inequality now than you had in the Stalin period. You know, you've got billionaires suddenly created. There certainly were advantages that the ruling party had, the top level of the ruling party had. But it's like peanuts compared to the corruption and inequality. You know, they finally have one of the biggest ones in jail. He made a mistake. He tried to use his economic power to gain political power. And the government didn't mind his getting economic power. That's the new corporate rules of the game. But they certainly didn't want him to be running the country. That's taken for granted in America, that economic power gives you political power. And then political power feeds back and gives you more economic power. But that's considered normal under capitalism. If you're a pro-capitalist ideologist, you will say, well, obviously the people approve of that because they keep electing people or parties that stand for that kind of action. And I think that that's probably true. Now, why it's true is something else. Another thing that Marx neglected, in addition to the possibility that the advanced country might not always be the first, is he underestimated the power of nationalism and religion and ethnicity. One of the proofs of that is that in Germany and in England and France at the time of World War I, there were very significant labor parties, very significant socialist movement. Here you have a war started, and what did they do? The German socialists supported the German, the Kaiser. The English socialists supported the English crown. The French socialists supported the government. And you undoubtedly had socialists killing socialists, which is something Marx never dreamed of. I understand why, because I make the same mistake myself, and that is Marxism is above all a rational analysis. And you think that it's perfectly reasonable for people to follow their rational interests. And yet they don't always do that. Consciousness is formed by so many different things. You can win the rationality race and be off in space in terms of what's really happening. Although We all make errors. Some make errors of optimism and some make errors of pessimism. I personally prefer making errors of optimism because at least you're in the direction of what's happening. Those who believe that change will never take place may be right 95% of the time. But the times that they're wrong are the real crucial junctures of history. But still, Marxism as a form of economic analysis needs to be supplemented by factors that examine the culture, that examine the psychology of people, that deal with racism and sexism. It's vital to analyze the market, its tendencies, its weaknesses, its S over V, and all of that. But we also need to look at how real people operate under real conditions. Do they follow their class interests? Well, we live in a country, in a world, at least the capitalist part of the world, that former non-capitalist countries like China and Russia are quickly joining. This part of the world operates in ways that prevent or distort class consciousness. We use terms like middle class. What does it mean? All it means is what income you're at. It doesn't show the social relationship that you enter into in the process of earning that income. Obviously, advanced countries have much higher levels of income than undeveloped countries. See, when you look at income and you observe certain periods in which workers' income has gone up, that doesn't mean that the workers have not been exploited. They have been, as long as they produce more value than they receive. Now, what's going on now is an indication that the benefits that the workers have gotten, the welfare state, higher income, all sorts of consumer goods, are not guaranteed for life. What has been given to them can be taken back. And that is what has happened, is happening. As for the notion of workers' productivity determining their income, what has happened is productivity is going up quite rapidly, like about 3% or so a year. And workers' wages over the last decade have gone up almost zero. So much for micro theory based on the assumption that there is no class conflict. Because we are witnessing one of the most dramatic shifts in the distribution of income. Not that we had a democratic distribution before, when do we date it from? Let's say Reagan. Far from it. You still had about 28-1 between the upper 10th and lower 10th. But that's being looked back on as the golden days. You have a vast increase in inequality. And the administration is quite proud of it. They make no bones out of the fact that they have lowered taxes on the rich, and they justify it on at least the implicit grounds that it is that class that is the vital investing force, the force for progress, and what goes to them will eventually trickle down to the rest of the population. And globalization is increasing that, because you've got inequality increasing on two levels. Both extreme. The less extreme is within the country. The most extreme is between the developed world and the undeveloped world, where the gap is simply enormous and increasing, where you have top 1% having in the world having wealth equal to almost 40% of the world's population. Now, that simply is staggering. Now, not everybody is bothered by that. I think we have been culturally acclimated to thinking that that's normal. Some of us have even bought the idea that the only kind of democracy is capitalist democracy, that if you embrace any other economic system, there's the theory held by probably most economists and many and probably a majority of the population, that you are on the slippery slope to authoritarianism. A major book on that, as far back as the 40s, is called The Road to Serfdom by a man named Hayek. More recent work is Milton Friedman, Capitalism and Freedom. And there are many other lookalikes. In fact, it even crosses racial lines. There is a growing number of blacks that are Milton Friedmanites with just a change in skin color. If you don't believe me, look for the works of a man named Tom Sowell, S-O-W-E-L-L, part of a conservative think tank called the Hoover Institute. What does this all add up to? I think what it suggests is that Marxism is not only relevant for the 20th century, but that it is absolutely essential for understanding where we're at and where we're going. Because capitalism has now reached a stage where it is cannibalistic, where there is what one writer called a race to the bottom. As America was beginning to lose out in the 70s and 80s to Germany and Japan, because they had a newer technology than ours, what we found out is that we could squeeze more out of the workers. Squeeze what out of them? Surplus value. The Europeans would have loved to have done that, but they had a stronger labor movement and more class consciousness. But they've been doing it, but slower. And that's why we are temporarily back in the saddle. But it's a prosperity that simply can't last, because there are fundamental contradictions that are coming to the surface. And one of the most extreme, and perhaps in the long run, the most extreme, is that we're destroying the earth, because the nature of capitalism is that it's myopic. It's the bottom line now, not tomorrow, not next year. The whole idea of a stable development and capitalism, they're in contradiction. And that's why I believe that capitalism is in a corner. It can only solve one problem by exacerbating another. In fact, that's my definition of being in a crisis. Because it's clear, one problem at a time, we can probably handle it. We can even prevent unemployment from getting worse, or deal with inflation, or even ameliorate racism or sexism to some extent. Not fully, because as long as there's a profit to be made, those things, once established, will be hard to eradicate. And so the nature of capitalist development is that it prepares the way, ultimately, for being superseded. It erodes its own base. In my opinion, at that advanced point, politics becomes the crucial pivot of society. It's no longer economics, it's politics. At some point, support for this existing alienating system, socially, psychologically inefficient system, has to give way. What it will give way for, we don't know. There is no guarantee that a post-capitalist system will be better on all levels than the capitalist system. It could lead to another Soviet-type system. But I think we have to operate as if we have a chance, because other than that, you end up approving of the system that exists. So at some point, I think that theory and action have to come together, because theory without action is an exercise in sterility. But action without theory is like a boat without a rudder and is bound to end up on the rocks. And I think it's the ideology of Marxism, more than any other orthodox ideology, that tries to look at social life as a whole and to raise the question, how can we move society to its next stage? How can we overcome the inequality, the racism, the sexism, the social inefficiency of our existing system and create something better than that.
Economist Mel Lyman from his lecture series, Teaching Radical Alternatives. Thanks to Jerry George of altbuzz.org for that recording. You can download copies of this and previous programs at our website, unwelcomeguests.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening. The rich will come.